Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Many of you know Axis deer is considered to be the best tasting venison on the planet. I've been hearing that for years. And that those deer cause some ecological harm. Well, Maui Nui Venison is bringing those Axis deer to the market, so you can get some fresh cuts and sticks shipped to your door. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's M-A-U-I-N-U-I Venison.com. Use promo code MEATEATER for 20% off your order.
This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Presented by First Light, creating proven, versatile hunting apparel from merino base layers to technical outerwear for every hunt. First Light. Go farther, stay longer. Hey, everybody. Join today in the Turkey Woods.
Yeah.
Very near the Turkey Woods with Whit Fosberg, president and CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. We're actually here on part of our fundraising mission.
We are.
Where we have the turkey hunt giveaway. We just hunted with the turkey hunt giveaway, people.
Yeah, so you guys are very generous in, you know, basically allowing us to sweepstakes you off. And two lucky winners came out here and hunted with you, Steve, and Yanni, and not fully successful, but I think everyone had a great time, and yeah, spectacular woods around here, Matt Cook's farm, great place.
We're still running an 80% success rate.
Yep. And just to give you an idea that, you know, in terms of what it did for us, I mean, we raised on this one $80,000+. Last year, it was over 120.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're making real money for conservation, and
so we gotta find some way to soup it up and get the numbers back up.
Well, I think it's, well, remember we did it last year, it was October, and then now it's May, so we had a much more truncated season, and people who had just entered were asking them to enter again. So I think as we move back out to an annual May cycle, because that's when our dinner is, we had to move it because of COVID, I think you're gonna see those numbers get back up.
Oh, really?
Plus, you know, to the extent that the guys like were here this time who had a great time, you know, they get the word out, and it's pretty cool. I mean, we had 3,000 plus people enter last time, and these two won, and super good guys, Western New York from Buffalo.
Me and Yanni were talking about switching it to doing a raffle for an elk hunt, wondering if that would make a huge difference or if it wouldn't make any difference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think, we could certainly try it and see it. Elk hunt, as you guys know, is much harder to put on in mm-hmm. general. But, you know, and this one, you know, is pretty darn easy, and it's a high success rate and
very fun.
And it's, you know, honestly, you're sitting in a ground blind with you or Yanni or sneaking through the woods. I mean, they're going to learn more on this about hunting and about you guys than they would probably in a lot of the elk hunting situations. Mm.
They learned I like to take me a little midday nap.
Yeah. Yep.
Whit, tell everybody how you got run over by a car. That's a good story.
So I've been bike commuting for 20 years from my office out to our home, and I live just outside the DC line in Maryland, and I've never really had a close call, but DC has been doing a really good job of revamping its bike lanes, and it's become a very good bike city, but you know, a lot of the passenger cars are not quite used to it yet. And so they moved a bike lane over near the Watergate on Virginia Avenue. The Watergate. So that both lanes are on the south side of the road. And so I'm heading home and it's dark and it's raining.
How long is your ride?
It's about 8 miles, 9 miles. But so it was dark and rainy and I'm heading into traffic. And a woman was running late for a performance at the Kennedy Center and just turned straight into me. And my bike goes under the car. I go over the car. And, you know, 3 broken ribs, broken clavicle, broken finger, separated shoulder. But, hey, I fly fished last weekend, so everything's good.
Yeah. How long ago did this happen?
February 24th, same day as the Ukraine invasion.
Wow.
Yep.
I would have never known that you're beat up just a couple months ago.
Well, part of that's the reason I haven't turkey hunted this year, because I didn't feel like putting a 12-gauge against my broken clavicle and pulling a trigger was a good idea.
Yeah, just shoot left-handed with a red dot.
Well, I could try that. I am very right-handed.
I thought of you there today because, you know, in the Salt Lake City airport, they have this by the F. Is it Salt Lake? Yeah, the Salt Lake City airport by the entrance to the F and G gates. They have this very large panoramic screen. And it's all advertising like Utah. So it's all these like gorgeous scenics and people skiing and mountain climbing. And then they got a fly fisherman. The worst cast I've ever seen. Everything's perfect with the, they didn't cast. They just did a horrible job casting the caster. Well, and they should have had you come in there and paste one out for their little video.
Well,
worst cast on the planet. That's panoramic screen.
That's one of the things that made River Run Through It successful is they didn't have, I guess Brad Pitt learned how to fly fish. But for the really beautiful fly fishing scenes, they brought in this guy from Wisconsin.
What was his name?
Borger. I'm forgetting his first name. His dad was a legend too, but who's just a world-class fly caster. And so all the sort of scenic fly casting shots you see are with one of the best fly casters in the world, and which makes a big difference.
Yeah. No, they should definitely had you. Okay, a couple things here. Here's a funny one. Someone sent us a text exchange, and it was someone saying, they were named Katie.
I thought it was from your wife.
No, different Katie. But you know what? A lot, like when I was a little kid, everybody named everybody Steve and Jenny. And then 5 years later, they named them all Katie. How many, I got more Katies in my life than I know what to do with. Here's another Katie. She's talking about how, her husband was reading my new book, Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, while she was in labor. Dude was getting out ahead of it, planning ahead. When my wife was in labor, my first kid, I passed out and had to have a nurse come resuscitate me. They got out that big ass, you ever see an epidural needle?
Oh, yeah.
Listen, man.
Seeing that made you pass out?
Yeah, because here's the deal, too. My wife did all the garbage to have be like the all natural, all these classes and all this practicing and shit. And they get there and they put the little heart monitor on the baby. And they're like, that ain't happening. Pulled out. So she's all upset. But then they pulled off this big, biggest needle I've ever seen. Looked like something you'd baste a turkey with. Like an injector.
Yeah.
And I just passed right out and woke up out in the hallway with my head in a nurse's lap. Yeah.
Wow.
I could cut your arm off and eat it, Giannis.
You wouldn't pass out.
But that needle going into my wife's spine made me pass out.
Wow. Has that ever happened to you before?
No.
You went?
No.
I like to think I was overtired.
I got really close. I mean, but we were in like hour 40 or something of labor and had not maybe had some cat naps, but not really. And it's getting very intense, but I'm also like just feeling my body shutting down.
Did you say hour 40?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause we went all natural the whole way and it went long, mega long.
Jeez.
Yeah. But that includes the beginnings, like where does the timer start? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Of labor. So, But yeah, I remember just being on my knees, kind of next to the bed with my arms on the bed, and just like looking at the midwife being like, okay, I think I'm just going to lay down. I have to lay down just for a little bit, just for a little bit. And I was like literally tapping out. But then Ina came out, and then we both went and took a nap.
I think you should count it from when the water breaks.
Hmm.
But I'm not a, you know, what do you call them? Maternity nurse or something like that. Mm-hmm. Guy wrote in, this is interesting. This is a thing to add to our list of things that make a turkey gobble, which we were heavy duty into for a long time, but kind of got away from it. A Chinook helicopter flying 100 feet off the ground as the propellers split the air. You know that sound? Says got every turkey in the woods gobbling. That's good.
But you know they can adjust the pitch on those and make it louder and quieter.
I wonder if you can set them to like ultra shot gobble setting.
Well, no, I happened to, when we went to hunt a region in Montana, I was talking to a wildlife biologist and he says, well, I won't be able to hook up with you because every morning and evening I'll be flying doing deer count. I said, well, if you're flying over where I'm going to be, do a couple of low passes and make that chopper really sound off and give me a couple free shot gobbles. I saw the chopper, but that didn't get any gobbles.
You didn't hear any gobbles off it. You've been following this, the corner crossing, Wyoming corner crossing case?
Yeah, not professionally as much as just as a citizen.
Yeah, as a citizen, that's what I'm guessing. Have we updated this yet? So we've been working on, I don't want to get out ahead of myself. A lot more to come on this subject, but just an update. This is a while ago now, the four Missouri hunters who were being tried for trespassing over having corner crossed in Wyoming were all found not guilty. However, three of the four hunters acquitted. So they were found not guilty in criminal trespassing, okay? But they had done the same thing at the same ranch. Oh, so they had done the same thing near there in 2020. So rather than, we did talk about this. I remember making the parallel. Remember how the juice wasn't in trouble for killing his wife in the waiter criminally, but then got in trouble for killing his wife in the waiter, Ron Perlman? Is that his name? Is that his name? Goldman? Just look up real quick. Who'd he kill?
I will.
Ron Perlman. You don't follow this, Whit?
No.
I could tell you where I was sitting when he was driving down the road trying to get away from the cops.
Oh, you're talking OJ now.
Who did you think I was talking about?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know
the Jews.
Yeah, yeah.
I was sitting in Bo Nicky's bar in Muskegon County, Michigan, watching OJ drive around in that truck.
Bronco.
Yeah, that truck would be worth a lot of money right now.
Yep. Goldman, I think it was his name, wasn't it?
Come on, yeah. This is the easiest web search in the world.
It's not.
Are you kidding me? When you type in OJ, Nicole Brown Simpson, Ron. I hope Phil plays like a ticking clock. I would have solved this 10 times.
Ronald Lyle Goldman.
There you go. Why was I talking about OJ? Oh, because
there's
I feel like we talked about this.
That you drew.
Meaning OJ was not in trouble criminally, but he was in trouble civilly. So the several of these guys are now facing a civil suit from a landowner from actions taken in 2020. I got a feeling that won't go anywhere. We often report on really how wildlife issues are so egregiously misreported in the news. And Corinne, who's not here right now, felt that for us to be fair, and morally consistent, we would have to point out our own egregious abuse of language in reporting wildlife news. If you go to the meat, we changed it, but if you go to the meateater.com, we had coverage of a fox that snuck into a zoo and killed, how many did he kill? A lot.
It's like 26.
25. A fox snuck into the Smithsonian National Zoo and killed 25 flamingos. There's a term for that. It's called, what's it called when they do like an overkill thing?
Oh, right. When they just sort of indulge.
Surplus killing.
Genocide.
No, like when a mountain, like when a mountain lion gets into a, like a pen full of llamas, right?
He just
can't help himself.
Yeah, they get excited.
Yeah, like kills way more than he can eat. Surplus killing. The fox got in there and somehow managed to kill 25 flamingos. Our headline, which we changed, we had an uproar, was wild animal massacres flamingo flock at famous American zoo. Which now we'll read if you go look. Wild animal kills flamingo flock at famous American zoo. Applying the same level of maturity to our own reporting as we do the reporting of others.
She has a crime scene in red down there too. Did she not like the use of crime scene for this?
That I was informed by Spencer. That was meant to be tongue in cheek.
Ah. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I could read you the text exchange I had with Spencer. Like Spencer always does, Spencer is disinclined to admit wrongdoing. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not going to give me my my answer from that last trivia round.
Oh, here's another here's another example of saving lives. A woman rode in from British Columbia out hiking with her 12-year-old. They got a moose kind of trying to attack them. And the 12-year-old had read our wilderness skills book and knew what to do from having read the book, and it worked. Scared the moose off.
Did we have a part in there about how to scare a moose off?
Yeah, we did. He did it.
That's good to know. That's more common than probably a bear charge, you know?
Yeah. This is one that has enormous implications for me and everyone that likes to hunt morels. Over the years, many people have liked to come forward and claim to have dialed in morel production. And it often winds up being not true or exaggerated. It seems like some Danish biologists, judging by the photos, some Danish biologists have now tamed the last true piece of wildlife in America. The one thing that man couldn't conquer has been conquered. The morel. Look at, they got a shitload.
What about
of them.
The huckleberry?
A huckleberry is a souped up. A huckleberry is a diminutive blueberry.
Right, but I thought they couldn't grow them.
Listen, if you talk, you ever talk to, oh, your wife's a botanist.
Mm-hmm.
Does your wife really buy into like huckleberries being like, it's a little blueberry?
Yeah, that's true.
It's the same way, like if you take a wild strawberry,
is
a wild strawberry
different.
Is small and more flavorful.
That's right.
But strawberries have absolutely been domesticated.
That's true. So yeah, if a huckleberry is just a blueberry, then yeah,
it's been domesticated.
We're in the middle of a lot of blueberries right now.
And the one thing that was the main reason that morels taste good, but the main thing I liked about them was that they couldn't be conquered. They were unconquerable. And the Danes, who make a hell of a good movie, have figured out cultivating morel mushrooms indoors year-round. The Danish Morel Project. 40 years of research. Collaboration with the Royal Veterinary and Agricultural University and the University of Copenhagen. The growing method of their black morels in a climate-controlled environment over a 22-week cycle produces 20 pounds of mushroom per square yard per year. So depressing. Because, like, when you see a morel, you're like, someone went out in the woods and picked that son of a bitch. You know what I mean? Found it. Now it'll be like whitetails. Morels are going to have the same problem that whitetails have. Like when you go into a house and see a giant whitetail, I'm always like, who knows? You know what I mean? Like, who knows? Who really knows? Is it a whitetail or is it not? Like, is it a fake whitetail? No, so depressing. The reason it was tough to cultivate wild morels is because of an extra step in their life. I'm reading here. In their life cycle, called the sclerodium, a word I had never heard. Sounds vaguely sexual. Sclerodium. To germinate in spring, the sclerodium can either form new mycelium, the root-like network of underground filaments, or they can form a fruiting body, which is the above-ground mushroom. The people remember, we had a big fight about this word before. I was calling it a macrofructation, but it is a macrofructification. Is the fruit, like, if you imagine the part that makes a morel is like a whole, there's a whole apple tree underground, but now and then it sticks an apple up above the dirt. The mycelium is the apple tree living underground. Instead of it producing fruit, aka an apple, it produces a macrofructification, which is the part you cut off with your knife. And the reason you're supposed to come off with a knife and not yank them out of the ground is so you don't damage the mycelium, which I don't know if that's, I've never heard if that's actually true or not. So, yeah, the death of one more cool thing. What do you think about that, Whip?
You know, I'm not a mushroom hunter, so I'd love to be, but never had anybody to teach me. It's one of those things that you just don't go blind into. Well,
I could teach you right now.
Well, we're sitting here at the table.
Yeah. And then you cut it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but that's maybe a morel. But there are a lot of other ones out there you don't know about.
Yeah. Yeah. My recommendation to budding my mycologist, Mycophiliacs, is mycophilia, right? That means you love mushrooms. Mm-hmm. Is stick to there's like the foolproof 4, the failsafe 4, the failsafe 5, foolproof 5. Depending on who you ask, it's like different ones, but there's certain just dead nuts, right? Puffballs don't taste good, really. People act like they do, but they don't. Are always edible. Like all the puffballs, the white puffballs are all edible. Morels, chanterelles are hard to mess up. Oysters are very hard to mess up. Just stick with those.
All right.
You don't need to be eating like the crazy ones.
All right.
I can't remember when. Maybe Corinne will put it in the show notes. We had a podcast episode, called Farewell Red Wolf, I think. And we had a red wolf expert talk about red wolves, red wolf recovery. For the first time in 4 years, a litter of red wolf pups was born in the wild. 6 pups in total, 4 females and 2 males, found last month in the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge in northeastern North Carolina. To give you a sense of the decline, 47 red wolves were born in the wild in 2008, down to only 4 pups 10 years later in 2018. U.S. Fish and Wildlife reported not a single red wolf birth in the past 3 years, 2019, 2020, 2021, until now. There are an estimated 15 to 17 red wolves in the wild today, with another 241 in captivity. You
wow,
think
I
people get
well,
you think people
you?
Get fired up about wolves in the Rocky Mountains? They get real fired up down there about wolves. Like that it's illegit, that it's not an actual species, that it's like a it's like a coyote hybrid, that the feds are sticking it down their throat, that it's conservation dependent, it's all a bunch of bullpucky, on and on and on. If you're interested in that whole debate, check out the episode Farewell, Red Wolf, and you will learn more than you can remember about it. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry
if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meateater. Spring is a great time to do something with your family. Do some spring cleaning, which I kind of started today outside, planning outdoor activities, which I'm always doing, taking a little trip to Hawaii with your kids for spring break, which I just did, which was great. You know what else you can do for your family this spring? You can shop for life insurance with Policy Genius. Make that part of your financial planning for the year. I've said it before 1,000 times. I'll say it again. When my wife and I, when we started having kids, we got serious about life insurance. And man, I felt so much better after we did. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, it may not offer enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. So save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. You know, I didn't realize this about myself before until I saw the terminology for it, but as a hydrator, I'm a chug person, meaning I go and go and go and go and go because I'm busy and thinking about what I'm doing. And then I go like, man, I need to hydrate. And then I just chug. And one thing that helps me chug a lot more and more frequently is Liquid IV, because frankly, water kind of bores me, but I love Liquid IV. 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients for everyday wellness, all in a single sugar-free stick. I love how convenient the packaging is for whatever it is I'm doing that day. Traveling, in the field, working in the office, I'm still drinking Liquid IV. It's satisfying, helps me get rehydrated, and even when I'm flying around, I just carry it in my pack. I keep it in my computer bag. 1 stick, 16 ounces of water, hydrates better than water alone. No artificial sweeteners. However you like to hydrate, grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier sugar-free in bulk nationwide at Costco, or get 20% off your first order when you go to liquidiv.com and use code MEATEATER at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code MEATEATER at liquidiv.com.
All right, wait, you ready to get into this?
Sure, anytime.
Fully recovered.
Yep, more or less.
What's going on in Washington, D.C.? Like, what's the, I mean, I know what's going on in Washington, D.C., but what's going on, like, in the bowels of Washington, D.C.? When you get outside of Supreme Court leaks and the war in Ukraine and inflamed partisanship and the January 6th committee.
So I'm going to start over on the administrative side, because the big thing right now is implementation of the bipartisan infrastructure law that passed in the fall, which is $1.2 trillion for roads and bridges, traditional infrastructure, but also billions for natural infrastructure. And, you know, that can range from, you know, migration crossings over highways to, you know, investing in seed sources for restoration to Everglades restoration.
How do they wedge that? Like, I'm glad. Mm-hmm. I'm supportive. But how do they wedge that in there? Because we're always annoyed when stuff gets wedged in that we don't want.
Yep.
But then when stuff gets wedged in that you do want, you're glad about it, but you don't complain.
So, I mean, a lot of this stuff, I mean, let's use Everglades as an example.
Yeah.
I mean, we
Sell me on it as infrastructure.
So what we did back in its wisdom in the mid-1900s, the Corps of Engineers channelized Central Florida to have the water go east and west, as opposed to flow south through the Everglades to Florida Bay that it had done naturally. And that's where you have things like the River of Grass and, you know, those iconic, you know, images of yesteryear. So the impacts of that have
Can we dive into that little story for a second? Yeah. I just want people to make sure. We had a podcast about this a long, long time ago. But I don't think people that haven't spent time on there can fully grasp what that was like.
Yeah, so you have an incredibly flat terrain that runs essentially across from mid to southern, all the way down to Florida Bay, that is one giant wetland.
It's the gradient is crazy. I forget what it is. We talked about it in that podcast, but it's like an inch over like a mile or a foot over a mile or something like that.
So the water would
It's like a many miles wide river.
Yes. And shallow and ecologically incredibly rich. But what it would do is take polluted water, you know, historically from developed areas in northern Florida. And by the time it reached Florida Bay, it would be cleaned up naturally. And Florida Bay was, you know, one of the best fisheries in the world. And then what happened after they channelized that and sent the river water east and west is you had one, Florida Bay was starved of fresh water, as was a bunch of the Everglades.
I like to point out to people, just so they know, in talking about the Everglades, a lot of times in history we skip like, what, like, for instance, now we're dealing with all the dams on the Columbia system, mm-hmm. right? And someone's like, you could have the idea that someone built those dams just to screw salmon, right? But it was, they're generating electricity. And some people point to the fact that when people like to define like how we won World War II, one of the things is we could smelt aluminum and produce aircraft faster than anybody.
Yep.
Because we had all that electricity.
Yep.
So at a time, it was like it was a deliberate thing, and then you move on, and then you deal with mistakes you made. But they had that in the Everglades. They had that flood. But I don't know what it killed, thousands of people.
But it was even more than that. It wasn't so much the impacts of people on flooding. It was largely mosquitoes. It was just how to get the water out of there faster. In general,
to quote, reclaim it.
Right. So you could then do more sustainable or more reliable agriculture in those mm-hmm. areas. You could have housing developments that didn't flood every other year.
Got it.
And so the downside.
So that was at least a lot. It wasn't someone being like, I got an idea to really mess things up.
Right. But I mean, at that time, Corps of Engineers across the country, channelized rivers, basically made them move faster, got rid of wetlands. And over time, we recognized the fallacy of that whole model. Mm-hmm. Which was, we needed those wetlands. We needed the curves in the river, which slowed down the velocities to mitigate the floods.
Yeah.
But we didn't really understand that at the time we were doing all this. We could do it because we could. And it seemed like a good idea at the time.
I always wish I could go back, and I'm sure you could if you a good historian could go back, is who were the, at the time, I'm sure they were labeled as lunatics and alarmists. Who were the people that were saying, you know what, man? If you do that, right?
Yep.
Those voices are lost, not lost to history probably, but lost to popular history, right?
Yeah, but they look pretty prescient now.
Like the guy on the Columbia River that was being like, if you do this, my feeling is that you will doom all of those salmon species to extinction. And people were probably like, you tree hugger.
Well, and at that time, you could even say, well, we'll just build a hatchery, which is what they did.
Right.
And, so that was the way they dealt with it there. But in Florida, we've seen the impacts because now you have the huge dead zones and, red tides and algae blooms coming off the east and west side for all this water, polluted water being shunted out. And, so that's having huge economic impacts, in addition to the decline of Florida Bay and the Everglades and, the various species. So we're in the process of restoring that to make it work way nature was supposed to make it work.
So is the infrastructure logic? And again, I support mm-hmm. the decision. I'm just trying to get to the law. Is the infrastructure logic that it was like a Corps of Engineers infrastructure project that created an issue?
Yep.
Meaning it was like earth moving, construction, dam building, putting roads on tops of dams.
And it's not going to get fixed naturally. We're mm-hmm. going to have to go back and re-engineer that system.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're doing in South Florida.
A core project, Corps of Engineers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And money's running through their budget, but also a bunch of other budgets. But that's just a classic example of natural infrastructure. Another would be, in the South Louisiana, reconnecting, the Mississippi River with this delta.
Yep.
Because we've basically put up huge levees and move all that water and all the sediment that's coming down the Mississippi out into the Gulf of Mexico. And so you have this huge land loss in Louisiana, where literally South Louisiana is sinking.
Help people understand why the land is vanishing.
Well, because historically the Mississippi River would braid out as soon as it, you know, got down past New Orleans, that area. And, you know, all that sediment would then settle and maintain, you know, this vast area of wetlands. And that vast area of wetlands, in addition to being good ecologically, is what protected, you know, places like New Orleans from hurricanes and, you know, tidal surges that would come in. Mm-hmm. And as we lose that, we expose, you know, the people, you know, to far greater risk. And we saw that obviously with Katrina and other events. So what we're trying to do now is to actually break some of those levees along the lower Mississippi River to allow the river to spread back out, to allow that sediment to dump where it's supposed to be, to, you know, keep, you know, try to end the subsidence that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And then also create a natural system that will protect, you know, flood surge.
That's easy to see on infrastructure, mm-hmm. because it was one of the main reasons you channelized the river.
Yep.
Was to make it predictable for navigation.
Correct.
Like if you go back and read Mark Twain, his book about the river captains, you had to have like a guy that knew how to navigate that river back in those days, which was constantly changing. You couldn't run deep vessels. You had to have very detailed, constantly evolving knowledge of how to get boats up the Mississippi Channel, because it changes all the time. And they just made it a straight shot, right, for shipping. So that's easy to see on infrastructure.
Yep. I mean, and nobody's really talking about that main shipping channel, you know, changing that.
Yep.
It is what it is.
I got
now.
You.
But as you get down past the, you know, New
yep.
Orleans,
yep.
you know, that is where we need to recreate those wetlands. Now, another example is things like, you know, the crossings over highways.
Oh, I got one more yep. question about the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Is the primary energy, the political energy to start rehabilitating the Delta, is the primary energy coming from a public safety regarding hurricanes, or is the primary energy coming from the conservation community?
All of the above. And I think that largely this is being funded through, you know, basically BP oil spill dollars.
Okay. So there's still some of that hasn't been spent.
There's still some of that, and it's going to be spent for several more years. That's going to be, you know, obviously, you know, kicked up through the infrastructure spending. But no, it's, you know, I think they recognize that it's, you know, critical to basically, you know, protect New Orleans and the people that live along there. There's also recognition that we're destroying that ecosystem, which is phenomenal, you know, fishery, waterfowl habitat, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everybody's come together, and this is one of those things like it's mom and apple pie in Louisiana, you know, by and large, that everybody agrees this is the right thing to do. But that's been a sea change in people's attitudes, you know, where we have a long history of controlling nature, and now we're trying to get nature to actually play a role in protecting us.
Yeah.
Just another example of infrastructure would be that, you know, the part, there's a pilot program in the bill that was passed in November of $350 million for expanding highway overpasses and underpasses for wildlife. And you see that in places like, you know, down in, you know, Trappers Point in Wyoming, and where they've, you know, done that already, and they're incredibly successful. I mean, animals use them, they reduce accidents with people and death, and, you know, so... And it's just, you know, it's, as we think about a changing climate and animals needing to move, I mean, having those basically intact migration corridors is more important than ever. So we're going to see a big influx of that. And it's not just, you know, for mule deer and elk and, you know, pronghorn in Wyoming. You know, this is going to be, you know, for reptiles and amphibians in New Jersey, getting under roads as they move in their spring migrations too. So it's a different, it's a pilot program, and it's going to be around the country, and it's a chance to show that it really works,
mm-hmm.
and to expand that. But it's just a different way of thinking about traditional roads and bridges. And we have so much better data today about, you know, how animals move than we did even a decade ago.
You can be much more targeted now.
Much more targeted. And you know where to put that overpass, and you know it's going to be used, and that's got to be combined with some fencing to push them into there. But, you know, that is, you know, that is a solution to a lot of problems, because, you know, if you look at a lot of the migration maps, they end right at, you know, I-5 or whatever it is in Wyoming. And that's not the way it's supposed to work.
Walk me through on those three examples, unless you're ready to move away from the infrastructure. Like before we leave the infrastructure.
Before we leave infrastructure, here's the challenge. So we have, you know, the billions of dollars for conservation in that infrastructure package. And we have agencies that are not equipped to handle that level of money. And getting it on the ground is going to be a huge challenge. Well, first of all, we've had years of basically bashing the federal government and talking about we need to downsize federal government. We've had attrition from all the natural resource agencies over the years. So you need to have an infrastructure in place, you know, to apply these funds, make sure they get on the ground, you know, in a reasonable way. Because nobody wants this money to be wasted. Nobody wants it just to sit in an agency's bank account and not get spent. So part of the challenge here, and we have a working group of our various partner organizations that is working on this, is identify, you know, places where this money can get put to get it on the ground quickly. For example, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, you know, which is handling a lot of the BP oil settlement funds, has a 30-plus year track record of doing great conservation work and knows how to get money on the ground quickly with very low overhead. You know, supersize the programs there to get that money on the ground. After Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, they created a coastal resiliency fund, managed a lot of the Department of Commerce funds that came into that to basically rebuild, you know, wetland habitats, barrier islands, all the rest, and incredibly successful, matched by private dollars, matched by state dollars. Use that same sort of model here, you know, to get the money out of the agencies to an organization that knows how to do grants, that knows how to monitor, knows how to evaluate, and knows how to get that money out quickly. And that's what's happening right now. So they just did an announcement a short while ago, $1 billion going to National Fish and Wildlife Foundation for a host of different projects, terrestrial, marine, yeah, you name it. And those are, you know, RFPs are on the street right now. So I think that's the big challenge is, you know, how do we make sure that all this money has been appropriated, you know, actually gets to good projects? And if it doesn't, you can see a change in administration, the committee is saying, well, you have all this unused money, we're going to rescind it and pull it back out. And nobody wants that to happen.
Yeah.
So I think that's a lot of the challenge right now.
Explain to me how, if you look at the role of TRCP and other players, when they're shaping what the infrastructure package will look like, okay, and they're creating legislation, and they have to keep in mind that it has to be passable, right? So it's not just like a wish list; it has to be somewhat pragmatic to get the votes, and it has to be signed by the president. At what point does the conservation community insert themselves into the dialogue to say, if we're going to be spending money on infrastructure, we need to be like spending it in these ways? And how do you keep it in the end from all the work just evaporating?
So it was very clear early on that infrastructure was one of those few areas that Democrats and Republicans could agree on. Yeah, you know, Trump talked about it, you know, Obama talked about it, Biden talked about it on the campaign trail. So back during the middle of the Trump administration, we started gearing up a campaign with our partner organizations. The way we're organized, we have 61 different groups under our broad umbrella. And then they mobilize into working groups on particular issues like infrastructure. And so we may have, you know, 20 different groups on this particular issue. And so we created a website years ago called Conservation Works for America that talked about putting people back to work through conservation projects and the benefits that would do for infrastructure, for natural habitats, for hunting and fishing. And based on that platform, then that basically gave us a seat at the table early on as it started getting negotiated. And so then as, you know, it became more real under when Biden came in, you know, then we were prepared the whole series of different road programs we thought needed investment. And, you know, and they were happy to have our support on this. And because they were trying to make it bipartisan, the hunting and fishing community tends to lean Republican. And so I think they valued our input and participation. And plus, it was the right thing to do. It met their, you know, climate objectives, met their jobs objectives, and met their infrastructure objectives. And it was something that, you know, was frankly pretty easy to get at the end of the day.
So at some point, someone comes in, they're like, I got an idea for you.
Yep.
Huh.
And plus, you know, think about the groups that are underneath the partnership. I mean, you have Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. I mean, these guys have been doing on-the-ground projects for decades. and they know what works. They know it doesn't work. They know the some of the basically impediments to getting money on the ground, be it NEPA analysis, be it matching fund requirements, things like that, that all need to be tweaked if you're going to get this stuff out and get it on the ground quickly. So there's a tremendous amount of expertise there, and this is this is right in those groups' wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we take advice from them, and then we coalesce around the lobbying, communication strategy, and try to push that through inside the Beltway. And then if we're successful, like we were this time, then there's a buttload of money that goes back out to these groups to actually put projects on the ground.
Yeah. If you go back to the Great American Outdoors,
mm-hmm.
What is implementation looking like there?
You have some of the same challenges. So just to remind your listeners, the Great American Outdoors Act had two big components. One was permanent and full funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund, $900 million a year for projects that conserve sensitive habitats, that expand access, that they could be fee acquisition, it could be conservation easements, it runs the gamut. That is only one time in the history of the program, it was passed in 1965, I think, have we had full funding of $900 million. So again, we have some of the same challenges with the agencies. The appraisal process is a real problem here, because the way that the federal appraisal process works is they'll look at a kick-ass elk or mule deer property in a place like Montana, but they appraise it on its ability to grow corn or soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these ridiculously low valuations that don't meet with today's, you look at a Hall and Hall brochure or something like that, and these amenity ranches that have great habitat are going for insane amounts of money. They have nothing to do with how much corn and soybean they can produce.
Yeah, I've heard frustrations from agency people about that, people should be clear that it makes sense and it seems like a good thing that the government can't just buy and insanely priced pieces of property. Yeah. Like, there has to be some sort of objective understanding of its value.
Yep. And that's in law.
Yeah, to keep taxpayers from getting screwed by someone making horrible financial decisions, right?
Yep.
Like paying $100 million for something that's worth $10 million. You just screwed taxpayers over. So it's supposed to have some discipline, but it doesn't keep up to speed. Or someone explained to me, they're still looking at like stocking rates of cows and calves on places that are absolutely going to sell as recreational wildlife habitat.
Right.
They're going to sell as recreational properties.
Yeah. The values have changed since the 1950s.
And
you're not competing
in the modern era, because it's not a thing where you're looking at contemporary comps.
Right. And you have a landowner that wants to do the right thing, like make this public, but it's really hard for them to do if they're getting off, 25%.
Yeah.
Of what they would get on the open market.
Yeah.
And so they're just not going to do it.
Yeah. Landowner might be like, it's got miles of trout stream, hundreds of elk, antelope. We see black bears. And the feds are sitting there like, it's got 13 acres of irrigated alfalfa and support 3 cow calf pairs per unit, or whatever. And some Texan comes in, he's like, I'll take it.
Right. We're having to deal with that issue. So that's in the process being changed, as we speak. And hopefully that gets done pretty quickly. But then you also have a sort of a different orientation.
How do they even, when you look at that, it's being changed, but how is it being, what specifically are they changing?
I think the methodologies, I don't think this has to go through Congress. I think this is an administrative act.
Okay.
And again, I've got people on our staff that know far more about this than I do. But what they basically need to do is, publish a new appraisal system, that reflects modern values. And that goes through a, rulemaking process. It takes a little bit of time. And so that whole process is underway right now. In fact, we had Tommy Boudreau, who's number 2 at the Department of the Interior, talk to our collective groups last week about his personal frustration with this, but the fact that it is moving forward and as fast as they can make it go.
Yep.
And just Washington doesn't do things quickly.
I've heard other stories of landowners' families that wanted to try to move ranch land into public access,
mm-hmm.
and just grew to be very frustrated by the time.
Yeah. I mean, some landowners can
like,
afford that.
I can't do this for 3 years.
Right. No, I totally agree. It's a very legitimate concern.
Yeah, there's a lot of economic uncertainty. Who knows what the market's going to be like? Like, I can't wait for you guys.
Well, and also the other thing about the Great American Outdoors Act, the Land and Water Conservation Fund, part of that is it really also has a little bit different orientation. I mean, we got a provision in that that requires that at least 3% of the funds, or upwards of $25 million annually, be used for projects that expand public access.
Okay.
So instead of
so
a
you 20- can measure it. Yeah. On that merit.
Yeah. So instead of a 25,000 acre, you know, Plum Creek holding someplace that you may be buy under Land and Water Conservation Fund, which may still be a great project, this also encourages the agency to look at maybe that half section someplace, you know, that may not be worth a whole lot by itself, but it opens up 10,000 acres of national forest behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's a different way of thinking even within the agencies that they look at this money and how it's going to get spent. Because it's not just big landscape level acquisitions. I mean, it's conservation easements, it's access easements, it's, you know, small fee purchases.
But it's hard to picture getting someone, getting a team of people with who can be nimble, make quick assessments, quick intelligent assessments, and be nimble enough to participate in the market right now.
So that's why you have the NGO component. So you have groups like Nature Conservancy, Trust for Public Land, Conservation Fund, that have done a lot of the early legwork in putting together the deals, mm-hmm. and making the public justification and getting the landowner trust. And then they're the ones that are primary interface with the federal government, saying, lining this up, saying, this is queued up, it's ready to go.
Got it.
And
so Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation does some stuff.
Elk Foundation is a perfect example. Yep.
Like, they'll work deals where ranchers who might even be members of RMEF come to RMEF and be like, we'd love to get our place protected, but
And then they become the interface with the federal agency or the state agency or whatever it might be that is, you know, would take ownership or hold the conservation easement. There are other times where these groups will actually buy the area in fee just because the landowner is facing, you know, a real crunch from cash and this can't wait, with the understanding that then they'll flip it to the federal agency.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that puts a big burden on the nonprofit because all of a sudden they're out however many million dollars that they're having to sit there and wait for the federal government to get its act together.
And there's probably always some apprehension that they'll change their mind.
Sure. I mean, and that's the risk of the game. But the groups like, you know, Conservation Fund, Trust for Public Land, I mean, these are pros. They've been doing this for years. I think they have a pretty good sense about, you know, this is going to happen or not. And now that you have a guaranteed stream of federal funding through Land and Water Conservation Fund, it's far more certain this is going to happen at some point. The old days, the real concern was, okay, well, we'll go ahead and buy this. But let's say Congress, instead of giving $900 million, only decides to give it $100 million. And that's competing with projects all around the country. Then you can really be screwed.
Are they having a hard time finding projects on the right timeline?
No. Plenty of projects out there. There's a backlog of projects that are ready to go. The issue is more on the just the administrative side, getting the, you know, appraisal process fixed, getting the people within the agencies to deal with, and three times as much volume of transactions as they've been doing historically, which means staffing up to a certain degree. So those are the bigger challenges. Now, you also have in the Great American Outdoors Act a $9.5 billion, you know, trust fund to address the maintenance backlog on public lands. You know, national parks, national forests, and that could be campgrounds, could be visitor centers, could be roads, could be trails. So, you know, that they're facing a lot of the same problems there too, about capacity. Because if you have an agency where's, you know, you have a lot less, you know, people than you had a few years ago, and all of a sudden you have this money to go do all this stuff, it's hard sometimes to get that money on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not going to go out there and build that visitor center. You're going to contract with somebody else, but you've got to do that due diligence on the front end. You got to go put out a bid. You got to go through the RFP process and make sure you're, again, not getting screwed because this is taxpayer money you're using.
Yeah. Explain the MAP Act.
So MAPLAND is an act that just passed.
So it's MAPLAND, MAPLAND.
Yep,
okay.
Yep, which is Making Our Public Lands Accessible Act.
It is an acronym.
It's an acronym. Yeah, but it's a nice acronym, MAPLAND. So this just passed the House and the Senate, signed by Biden 2 weeks ago. Unanimous vote out of the Senate.
Oh, is that right?
Yep. And what this does is...
Unanimous.
Unanimous, yeah. So
I knew it passed overwhelmingly, but I didn't know it was unanimous.
Yeah, it was overwhelming in the House. I think we had like 9 people that voted against it, and then unanimous in the Senate.
You know, you haven't explained it to people yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious now. The 9 that didn't like it, what didn't they like about it?
Anti-federal government. You know, it's going to cost some dollars. It could, you know, sort of fall on the taxpayer concern. It's basically people that don't like conservation.
Yeah.
And
so out of the
spending money,
out of the almost 400 people hanging around the House,
yeah,
9 didn't like it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then every senator liked it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, what it does, this goes back to the projects we did with Onyx that identified landlocked public lands. And, you know, in that process, we went through a multi-year and a series of different reports, and anybody can read them on our website. But identify all these lands that the public owns, the public can't get access to because there's no legal access right. Well, in the process of doing that, we discovered that there are a whole lot more legal access rights that we know about. And Joel Webster, who runs our Western Lands or Western Conservation Programs, you know, he and the folks at Onyx.
That dude is one of the sharpest minds.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to,
I mean, I
land designations, land access. Yeah. Holy shit.
I mean, I think of him like our little mad scientist in the back room concocting new schemes to protect public land, to expand access. And
when I'm talking to him, I'm always like, how in the world does he know all that?
Yeah.
Well, I'm so distracted by wondering how he has.
I mean, he lives it. So, I mean, you know, hardcore public land hunter.
Yeah, you'd be like, you know, when you see like a railroad crossing and it says something or another on the map, but then next to that it says something or another about DOT or whatever, he'll be like, oh, that's because of I was like, no shit, really?
Yeah, so, but talking back to the map land, I mean, part of this process with Onyx, they discovered that the agencies, and this is really Forest Service and BLM, you know, had somewhere around 50,000 negotiated access easements, of which somewhere around 5,000 actually been digitized. So you knew about them through a public process. So if you're using your Onyx or something like that, it would show up. The rest of them are in boxes in the basements of ranger districts someplace. And we asked the Forest Service.
Do you mean literally?
Literally.
Do you mean, no, that if the building burnt down?
Yes. Well, as it is right now, nobody, the people that are there, these may have been negotiated 50 years ago. People that are there now have no idea about them. A landowner may have put up a gate someplace long time ago, nobody really noticed. Everyone assumed it's been off limits forever.
Yeah, and he sold it 3 times.
Yeah. So we asked the Forest Service, and Forest Service is probably the worst. I mean, they've got 35,000, you know, access easements, of which, you know, far less than 5,000 have been actually digitized. So we asked them how long it would take you guys to get this stuff basically into a 21st century format. And they're like, well, our current levels of funding, probably between 10 and 20 years. And so what we did was, you know, Joel and his team drafted up this bill that would give the agencies the money they need, give them a 2-year window to get this all done, tell them to get together to come up with a common data set, because of course the agencies all have their own process and their own data standards, and get it done. And so, you know, that's what passed Congress. And I think this is going to be a real game changer for a lot of the public land access. Because then if you have your handheld GPS, your Onyx, your whatever your format might be, you're going to see, you know, where we have legal access rights. And there are going to be a bunch of stuff showing up that we had no idea was there.
We have a mutual acquaintance.
Okay.
His name is Carl.
Yes.
He recently had a very interesting, I'd like to have him explain this himself in long form. I'm not going to talk about where it is. We just had a very interesting discovery in the Midwest where he's looking at maps and sees that there's this block of state land and there is a hundreds of yard long strand on a map marked of like what appears to be state land that's literally feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
He's a lands expert.
Yep.
So he noticed something that maybe he wouldn't have noticed. He goes over to have a look, and it is the windrow between two crop fields, which is piled up with rock over the years. Farmers kick up rock, throw it in the windrow. It's rock and briar. but it's a windrow. And he goes and does some research, and it turns out this is owned by the state. He goes and has a chat with one of the neighboring landowners who assures him that it's been closed, right? He goes to the state office. And they're like, that hasn't been closed. You can definitely use it. There hasn't been a trail there, but it was meant to be. And in fact, I don't know what happened. That guy has asked us to close it. We don't really know what that means.
Yep.
And he walks down that son of a bitch, gets down there, and guess what he finds? All kinds of, this is a place you can't bait, all kinds of bait piles. <It's just> like,
hey, man. And
so he now has been, and then he parked, and he can legally park on the right of way. And he does this trudge. He says it takes him about an hour and a half to go down this thing to get to this lake that's otherwise inaccessible. And the guy leaves notes. I'm calling the sheriff. He goes and says, let's call the sheriff together. Well, I'm not calling him right now, but just a crazy story, man.
I don't think that's isolated.
It's not federal, but it's state, right? Yeah. But it's not isolated.
It's not isolated. I think you're going to find, as we do this process and get this implemented, you're going to find those all over the place. Mm-hmm. And as you talked about corner crossings a little bit, I mean, this all sort of plays into, you know, one way to deal with overcrowding in a bunch of our public lands is to expand access to the public lands that nobody has access to right now. And Mapland is one tool to help us do that. And it's not infringing on private property rights because we own these. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe the new landowner doesn't know that, but this is going to help, I think, long term with reduced conflicts with private landowners because, you know, this is the way it is. It's going to be digitized. Everyone knows where it is and everyone knows where it isn't.
That's the thing I think people need to, it's the thing I'd like people to recognize is it's instead of the public going and sort of like taking something from a private landowner, it's that, and I'm not saying that, it's in effect, the private landowner has taken something from the public.
Correct.
The private landowner is utilizing as their own something that isn't theirs. So if you believe in this whole, like, you know, this whole idea of property rights and stuff, we're simply, the public is simply asserting its property rights.
And
it's saying the public have access to certain things. We'd like to clarify what it is and utilize it.
And there may be no malice on the landowner's part. I mean, you mentioned, it may have, you know, changed hands two or three times since this was negotiated. He probably had no idea, he or she.
And it's got to be a rude awakening.
Yep.
You can, I can easily get in the head of someone who has been on some chunk of ground for, you know, 20 years, and all of a sudden someone says, hey, you know,
hate to break it to you, but
it turns out your driveway is a road.
You know? Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Of course you're gonna resist. Right. No one's gonna be like, oh, well, in that case, welcome.
Yeah. But it is what it is.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. Man, I've had a Helix sleep mattress for years, and man, that thing is nice. The Helix lineup, just comfortable. It feels good, and you don't get all like, it's not all like hot and sticky in the summertime. It's not cold in the winter. The Helix lineup offers 20 unique mattresses, including the award-winning Lux Collection, the newly released Helix Elite Collection, a mattress designed for big and tall sleepers, and even a mattress made just for kids. Take the Helix Sleep Quiz and find your perfect mattress in under 2 minutes. And your personalized mattress is shipped straight to your door free of charge. Helix knows there's no better way to test out a mattress than by sleeping on it in your own home. That's why they offer a 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty to try out your new Helix mattress. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/meateater and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, meaning you put them on, they feel great. Little or no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, their direct-to-consumer pricing keeps value on your feet and money in your pocket. Just ask my buddy Chili, who's been slipping around in his Tecova boots, talking about how great he feels in them. He loves them.
Yeah, Steve, they're very comfortable. They're very fashionable, and I enjoy wearing mine around the office and anywhere I go around Bozeman.
Stop by your local Tecova store, have a complimentary drink, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and a friendly staff are at your service. Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. And find your new favorite pair of boots today.
There's a bunch of other stuff we're working on right now. There's a bill that's pending in the Senate called Recovering America's Wildlife Act.
And that's a slam dunk, right?
Oh, no. No. No, this is a, you know, I mean, it's, we've got 16 Democrats, 16 Republicans on it, and this is in the Senate. So, I mean, it's got good bipartisan support, but it's going to cost, you know, $1.4 billion a year. And anytime that you have something that's that expensive, there's going to be opposition to it. We know that. And it's not going to be something that sails through 100-0.
Huh.
But, you know, the rationale behind this bill.
But you have a split number of Democrats and Republicans supporting it.
Yeah. But that's, you know, still 30 or 32 out of 100. And yeah,
well, have the other ones not heard about it yet?
Oh, they may have heard about it. They just haven't signed on as co-sponsors. When they sign on as co-sponsors, we know we got their vote. And we've been very deliberate of making sure that for every Democrat we get, we're going to get a Republican to keep this bipartisan going the way through.
And you got how many?
32 right now.
How many of them have you talked to?
We've talked to all of them.
Well, you only got 18 to go, and you're halfway, and you're at the...
Sure, but you also have the filibuster in the Senate, which means you have to get above 60.
Oh.
And, yeah, so, but anyway, I think we can get it done, but it's not a slam dunk by any means. But what this bill would do is invest this money, $1.4 billion a year, to states to work on essentially non-game wildlife issues, and with the goal of keeping species off the Endangered Species Act list. And you think about, you know, the state agencies, which have primary jurisdiction for managing wildlife, you know, somewhere in that 60% plus of their annual budgets come from sportsmen. You know, through, you know, the excise taxes that go back out to the states for, you know, fishing tackle, ammunition, guns, archery equipment, motorboat fuel, all the rest, and licenses that we all pay and the tags we buy and all that. So sportsmen are basically paying for wildlife management for years. And some of that, you know, is understandably the agencies use to deal with things, butterflies, bats, you know, whatever the non-game species might be. But it's not a sustainable model.
Mm-hmm.
And several years ago, the states developed what they call their wildlife action plans, which is what they would need to deal with all these species that are in decline that will probably eventually get listed and, you know, cost a ton of money to recover. So how do we get ahead of that? And they added up, you've added up the 50 states and the territories, and it came out to $1.4 billion a year, which is why we came up with that number. So, and this, you know, it's a penny-wise, you know, this is a good investment to save a lot of money down the road. Because, you know, if it, as we say, if it species gets down to a red wolf status, and we're spending however many tens of millions of dollars, you know, to try to recover that species, it would have made a whole lot more sense before it got to that level, and red wolf may be a bad example, to spend, you know, to spend that money in advance to make sure that these species aren't, you know, collapsing. And plus, we're really talking about habitat management. So we're talking about, you know, projects, if you think about something like the sagebrush steppe, you know, sage grouse is obviously an iconic species there, but we also have 350 other species that are not really game species that occupy that exact same ecosystem. So honestly, the reason we've been pushing this as much is, one, we think that we need that investment, but two, this is going to help game species as well, because we're really going to be investing in habitats and not just single species management. So we think it makes a ton of sense. We hope we're going to be able to get it done this year, but you know, it's, again, I think it's going to be a fairly heavy lift.
There's a couple things I want to touch on. I want to back up a little bit. We talked about Great American Outdoors Act, okay, and the Land and Water Conservation Fund. I feel like a lot of people are sitting there being like, where is all this money coming from? I just want to point out, we didn't cover this, but in the case of the Great American Outdoors Act, which is funding LWCF, Land and Water Conservation Fund funding, that was a deal struck when?
About 1965.
Okay, in 1965, it was that when an oil company is leasing from the American people offshore oil field land. So it's like you get out, how many miles you got to get off the coast before you're out of state water?
3 miles, generally.
Okay, so if you let's say you live in California, and you get in your boat and start heading west, you are in California water for a few miles, and then you enter United States water, and that goes, I don't know, quite a ways.
200 miles.
200 miles. So that's land owned by the American people. Someone's going to go drill for oil. A for-profit venture is going to go drill for oil. Well, they're striking a deal with the American people saying, like, we would like to lease this oil site from the American people to drill oil, to sell oil. That is where this revenue comes from. It's a percentage of the lease fee. So we're saying, as Americans, you know, like our representatives are saying, okay, you're going to pay us X to use our land to draw oil from, and we're going to say that a percent, like how many percent of that, do you remember what it is?
I can't remember. It was, you know, it's, the percentage would have changed by now because it was a set dollar figure.
Okay.
$900 million.
Okay. So they're saying of that money, this amount, like of the money you're paying to us, America, we're pledging to spend this amount on access conservation projects. So this isn't like money that is just getting pulled out of thin air.
No. This was a deal that was struck back then that allowed the Outer Continental Shelf to be opened up for oil and gas development. And then the oil industry in return agreed to pay into this fund to pay for conservation on land.
Yeah.
And it was a, you know, a great model, and it's worked well. The exception that the legislation was written in a fashion that didn't make that funding until the Great American Outdoors Act passed mandatory. So every year Congress would see that $900 million and decide, well, let's not appropriate maybe $900 million. Let's do $400 million.
Even though we were supposed to.
Or $100 million. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't protected from that. So Congress arrayed it for all sorts of other purposes.
Mm.
And that was what got fixed in the Great American Outdoors Act.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, $900 million today is not worth the same as it was in 1965. It's still a lot of money, but it's a fraction of what it was originally intended to be.
Yeah.
It would have been better if it was a percentage.
Oh, it would have been. But, you know, listen, I'm happy we get $900 million dedicated for this, because it's a whole lot better than what we were getting.
In the case of let's take this Recovering America's Wildlife Act situation. So here's the thing that is helpful to consider. I remember I was talking with a policy guy that worked on grizzly bear policy. And in the lower 48, grizzly bears are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And someone was telling me that the state of Idaho, through the Fish and Game Agency, which is funded by hunters and anglers, they spend half as much on every annually. They spend half as much on every grizzly bear that lives in Idaho as they do on every kid enrolled in public school.
I would be skeptical of that number, but okay. All right.
There's a couple. No. Listen, I got it through the New York Times fact checker.
All right. Okay.
And they don't let anything through.
Run it again.
The state of Idaho
yep.
was spending... they're spending it costs them like $9,000 per year per kid for public school.
Mm-hmm.
If that was, I don't remember the exact numbers, but something like that. The state of Idaho is spending $4,500 on every grizzly bear in that state.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. Sorry. So you're not talking about a cumulative total.
No, I'm saying they spend half as much per bear.
Yeah.
As they do per kid to put them in public school.
Yeah, I believe that.
To put into context, like what it costs, what it costs to manage imperiled species. It's expensive to manage imperiled species. So when you get into this question of, is there a better funding mechanism than having a state, which is get all of its funding through hunter angler participation or excise taxes on sporting goods to have this like chunk of money spread so thin, as like you're saying, as we have increasing numbers and sure to have more species make the endangered species list.
Right.
It's at a point you're going to be like, at a state level, we can't do it anymore. I know there's like federal mechanisms too, but at a point you're going to be that, we're trying to, and I know that state fish and game agencies are encouraged not to think this way anymore, where they look at like that they have a clientele. Their clientele being like hunters and anglers.
Right.
And hunters and anglers want to see lots of elk, lots of turkeys, lots of trout.
Just well-managed resources.
Yeah. And so they're like, I want my money. Like I'm paying the money because I like to hunt. I want you to take my money and make sure that these things that have all this public support are viable and you don't have people buying butterfly
stamps. Yeah.
So there's a hole.
Huge hole.
In how we look at this stuff.
Yep. Yeah. And I just think that, triage is not where we want to get. We want to protect the ecosystems that maintain these species that are on the decline. So they never get to that triage situation where it costs so much money. And that's what this whole act's about.
Yeah. And even if you're not a butterfly lover, I can just about guarantee you that if it's good for the butterflies, it's probably going to be good for your turkeys and deer too. Yeah.
Oh, indeed.
There aren't many habitat moves that turn out being bad for something.
Yep.
There's not many cases where you go help one thing.
No.
And it turns out being bad for something else.
No, that's right. A couple other things is worth noting. We just had a big milestone on striped bass on the east, which is the number one marine recreational fish in America.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Is that in terms of angler hours?
Angler hours. Yep. Economic impact.
Gotcha.
And it's huge. I mean, it goes all North Carolina all the way up pet through Maine.
I've never even caught one. You caught one?
Awesome fish.
And it's good to eat too, right?
Great to eat. Yeah. And it's really, unlike something like a bonefish or a tarpon, it's an everyman's fish.
Yeah, you catch it from the beach.
It's blue collar. I mean, you can catch them from the beach. You don't have to have a fancy boat. You can catch them on a fly. You can catch them.
I used to walk down to the beach in Rhode Island, walk up and down the beach till I saw a bunch of them.
Yep.
Smash. Then you catch out there and you actually catch a whole bunch of bluefish.
Oh, yeah.
But now and then, wham!
Yep.
There he is.
So anyway, the striped bass, you may remember, there was a full moratorium back in the 1980s. They were so overfished.
Like, it got bad.
It got really bad. So, what drove how bad it got? Oh, overfishing. 100%. I mean, there was, some habitat stuff, too. But it was primarily
recreational?
Overfished. It was recreational and commercial. I mean, recreational is the bigger part of the problem today.
Like, recreational anglers actually put a hurt on that fish.
Big time. I mean, commercial did, too. But today 70% of the fish that are caught by or killed by recreational anglers.
God, really?
Yeah. I mean, that's how popular the fish is.
I always run around telling people that like regulated recreational fishing is negligible.
Well, I mean, regulated is the key word there.
Got it.
And we just didn't do what we needed to do at that time to regulate it properly. and until it was too late. Then we had a full ass moratorium on commercial and recreational harvest for years.
And was it because people are killing big females?
That was certainly part of the problem, yeah. And you have a big female, a 40 or 50 pound female, can lay, I forget, a million eggs or something. I mean, they are incredibly fecund. And but we were, you know, starting to lose them, and also you're killing, you know, you're just killing too many fish, period. And even catch and release, you know, we are far better today at, you know, surviving, you know, knowing how to do that properly without huge, you know, impacts. I mean, if you're using live bait, you know, with treble hooks, you know, and you're letting the fish swallow it, you're not going to release that fish, even if it's below the slot limit or you want to, you've already caught your limit for the day, that fish is going to die. Yeah, so mm-hmm. you know there've been a lot of advancements in, you know, basically reducing mortality, but the species has still been in basically steady decline for the past 20 years. And the last management action that was taken in 2003 or 2004, and that was what they call Amendment 6 to the Striped Bass Plan, and that's been intact till today, and basically has been, you know, in place as we've been watching this steady decline. And so, yeah, finally, this year, in fact, just this past month.
Is the decline in total numbers, is the decline in, like, numbers of large, sexually mature fish?
Total numbers at this point.
Okay.
So, but there are different management triggers they look at to determine, you know, whether overfishing is occurring. You know, they do stock assessments. They do young of the year indices in the key spawning areas. You know, so overall, they will look at those, and that determines whether, you know, the stock is okay or whether it's, you know, being overfished. And right now we've been in a constant state of overfishing. So the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, which is the, you know, basically the body made up of all the states on the Atlantic coast, you know, finally adopted last month something called Amendment 7, which dramatically changes how we're going to be managing striped bass. It makes it much better for conservation. Now, rubber is going to hit the road in October when we have the stock assessment this year. We didn't get stock assessments during the pandemic mm-hmm. because they were not doing it. And so we'll actually sort of see how bad it is come October. And if it's really bad, you're going to see a whole bunch of triggers put in place to reduce mortality.
Give me a preview.
Well, we've already had certain things done last year, like requiring circle hooks on live bait. Yeah, because the again, that treble hook is not good for catch and release. But you know, what it could be is, you know, I mean, it gets pretty wonky pretty fast, and you can go on our website and read all about this. But for example, there is something called conservation equivalency, which means that in a place like the Chesapeake Bay, which doesn't have as big fish much of the year, they allow you to catch fish that are much smaller and keep some because there simply aren't that the slot isn't in there, you know, when people are fishing in the summertime. And that's been abused over the years. So they're finally going to, if continued overfishing is occurring, that goes away.
I want to make sure I'm getting this right. Mm-hmm. They have a slot limit. Yeah. But then guys are like, dude, I'm not catching one that I can keep.
Well, if you're in the Chesapeake Bay, I mean, those fish that are in the slot have moved out in the summer. And they're up
and so
in
based on
Cape
like
Cod.
Based on angler feedback, they're doing right. an adjustment.
Yeah, like the
sort of like, never mind the slot.
Never mind the slot. You guys get to have a different, you know, management regime down here to allow people to fish.
Got you.
And we're just killing way too many fish. And so, you know, if it's decided that overfishing is still occurring come October in the stock assessment, then, you know, that is going to go away. So, you know, tough. I mean, we just can't kill small fish.
Can I share with you three quick striped bass?
Go for it.
Things. I spent several months in San Jose, California, one time when I was working on a book. And I had I would call him my fake Uncle Don because he was like not even, he was sort of a relative, like a step, seemed like an uncle, but he wasn't even kind of close to my uncle. Anyways, he would take me out trolling in San Francisco Bay for striped bass. And he would troll so close to the San Quentin. You know who was in there at that time? Was that, remember that guy that took his wife out, says he took her out sturgeon fishing?
Yeah.
Killed her and sunk her down in the bottom of the bay?
Vaguely.
Well, he was in there. Lord knows who else. We would troll so close to the guard tower at San Quentin that we'd wave to the guards and catch them good.
Oh, yeah.
And in the upper Delaware, I used to go fish the upper Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
way up where it's like Pennsylvania, New York.
Yeah, Hancock, that area, yeah. East of the West Branch come together.
You're catching trout, right? Like, oh, there's like rainbows and browns.
That's where I was fly fishing 2 weeks ago.
Well, sometimes you've probably seen this happen. I'd be in my canoe, you know, you're catching like rainbows, smallmouths, whatever. And all of a sudden, like you'd look down in some hole and just stripers as long as your leg.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know because I was new to the area. I didn't know that was a thing. And I'd be like, you know, normally you see something like that, you're like, oh, it must be a carp, right? Like something like that big, but they're fast. And I was like, what in the? I thought I discovered a new species. Oh, yeah. Someone's like, no, dude, striped bass will come all the way out of the ocean and come up here.
So the Delaware is the longest.
This is like a trout stream.
It's the longest stretch of undammed river in the eastern United States. So all the way from south of Philadelphia up to upstate New York.
I thought I was hallucinating until someone explained what I was looking at.
Yep.
Were they ever hitting that kind of stuff?
Oh, sure.
I can't even imagine.
Oh, I've got friends that target them. Yeah.
I can't imagine.
There aren't that many that stay up there, but the ones that get up there are often like, you know, I may not go back out of the ocean because there are all these tasty little trout in here.
Oh, just incredible, man. My final one is this dude my brother Danny used to work with was in Connecticut, and he took me out one night, and I don't know what the hell river it was. We wait out in the river like the darkest night imaginable. And I can't tell anything that's going on. You can just see the house lights. And we're standing in a river like, you know, up to your crotch in some river. I can't see. We got there in the dark. No idea what's going on. And he's like, just cast out there, you know. And I'm like, this is the stupidest thing in the... Like, this would never work. And boom!
Oh, yeah.
One of those things hits in the dark. Dude, it was amazing, man. Yeah,
and that's the time to fish it
up there.
That's
a cool fish.
Because, you know, Long Island Sound around there is, you know, there's a lot of people. And you go during the day, there are people everywhere. And you get out there at night and these little coastal rivers or flats.
Yeah, we're right in the mouth of a river.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there's nobody around. And, you know, the fish come in and they've hit better at night than they do in the daytime anyway.
Generally. Yeah, it's so dark when you cast that plug. You couldn't even, like, the plug just sort of vanished into the darkness. Like, you have no idea, like, where you cast.
No, I did that for years, and I'd love that.
Oh, he was hooked. Yeah. I thought it was a riot, man. But, you know, you get that feeling, like, I don't know what you got going on, but there's no way this, like, you can't catch fish like this. Yep. This doesn't work like this.
So, anyway, I think that the future is finally looking a little bit brighter for striped bass, and hopefully we can stem this decline and start a recovery. Now, there are other things that are working against it, you know, from, you know, maybe the Chesapeake Bay isn't as productive as it used to be due to climate, getting a little warmer.
How much pushback do they anticipate from fishermen?
Very little.
Really?
So right now, I mean, and this is one of the cool things about this process, basically the entire recreational community, you know, was on board with, you know, taking very strong steps for conservation, which is a change. And I mean, listen, well, I'll take a little credit for that because, you know, we helped assemble the coalition of AS, American Sport Fishing Association, Coastal Conservation Association, Congressional Sportsman's Foundation, National Marine Manufacturers, others, to make sure that we were all on the same page. Because, you know, there are other groups, you know, going to be good on this, but, you know, our community, especially like the industry, you know, just hates the thought of, you know, fewer people on the water and, you know, less economic activity. But I think everybody finally recognized that if we don't take some steps now, it's going to be, we're looking at another moratorium down the road.
Mm.
And that helps nobody.
You know, that's in people's memory.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Vivid.
Gotcha.
How do they do these counts?
So, you know, I don't know how they do the stock assessments. They do young of the year indices in the Chesapeake Bay and the Hudson River, which are the two main spawning areas for striped bass. And they have certain areas they go to all the time. And, you know, they see, you know, basically, you know, this time of year, they'll go in and do surveys or a little bit later about the young, because they'll come up there, you know, the striped bass, like in DC, will swim all the way up the Potomac past DC and spawn. And they, you know, come up there in that, you know, February, March, you know, time frame. And then spawn, the little guys come out, and there are certain areas where the little ones tend to congregate where you can go and do little seine surveys. And you use the same methodology year to year, you come up with some pretty good trend lines over time.
Yeah.
And they've been bad trend lines of late.
Hmm.
And we also have things like, you know, blue catfish are now in the Chesapeake, which tend to love to eat little stripers.
Hmm.
And that's an invasive species that was never there before. So, and people in the Chesapeake Bay aren't used to whacking them, even though they're great eating and, you know, good game fish. But so they're out there and they're relatively unmolested, except they're doing a lot of molesting of striped bass.
So people got to start keeping blues.
Oh, big time. Hit them hard.
That's some good eating fish, too. People mm-hmm. like to look down on the old catfish, but...
Delicious.
Yeah. Yep. Clean it up right and fish fry it.
Yeah, especially if it's been eating striped bass and like hanging out the sewer system outfall.
Another question for you for the Recovering America's Wildlife. Are there non-hunting, non-sportsman groups that are like chipping in, helping out, pushing for it?
Oh, absolutely.
Like the butterfly lover groups?
Absolutely. The environmental community is strongly behind it. I mean, this is another one where there is really no separation between what we want, what the environmental community want, so everybody who cares about wildlife wants this to happen.
When you're in a meeting, and there's a lot of different wildlife interests in the room, including a lot of people who are probably like instinctively adversarial to the hunting and fishing community. Are you guys just all business?
Oh yeah. And honestly, there aren't that many groups. I mean, listen, PETA, Humane Society, they don't deal in federal policy.
They don't?
No. They're much more comfortable, throwing fake blood on somebody wearing a fur, or something like that. So, I mean, they're not involved in these negotiations. And, honestly, groups like Sierra Club supports hunting. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't make a big,
But like that. A group like PETA does it. I never thought about that. They're not a federal policy group.
I mean, maybe they do in some places, but no, we've never bumped into them.
Got it.
So we work really closely with groups like Audubon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which are,
they're probably like pretty agnostic to it.
No,
right?
Absolutely. They're fine with hunting. I mean, they're just about good management. And, so we've worked with them a ton on sage grouse, on infrastructure, on a variety of other things. And they got great staff. They have, long, proud tradition. They have good chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And, some members of Congress would rather hear from Audubon. Some would rather hear from the Boone and Crockett Club.
Got you. Do you feel that the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, if it doesn't get done before midterms, is just all the hubbub of midterms going to kind of just, I mean, will it just
so
never come
be,
up again?
So, so basically we have a working period between now and I would guess August recess. After the August recess, nothing's going to happen basically until after the election. After the election, there
after
could
the
be,
midterm.
After the midterm.
Yep. And then there'll be like another little bit of activity.
There could be a lame duck session, but that all depends on what's happened in the election.
So it's time. The time to do this is now.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, listen, we've got the wind at our back right now. We've had Great American Outdoors Act. We just got Mapland. We've had, the America's Conservation Enhancement Act. We have a variety of other things that are pushing through that we have managed to get done. And I really feel that, momentum's on our side. We got to use that.
To close out, explain to people, and you've explained it before, explain to people the unexpected goodness of times of inflamed partisanship.
Yeah, it's not, D.C. in general is not a fun place to be in these days, especially if you're a member of Congress and you want to do the right thing. But in this very broken system we're in, it turns out that our issues tend to be ones that, folks can come together on. Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. And, so in most members of Congress, I'm a little Pollyannic on this, are there for the right reasons. They want to do public policy. They want to make a difference. They want to do what's right. And we're giving them things that, Republicans, Democrats can support. They're good on the ground. Yeah, they can be proud of for multiple reasons, from hunting and fishing to climate to access. And we're just in a sweet spot right now.
Like if they want to have some win,
yeah,
they can often turn to conservation.
Everybody wants a win. And and these are ones that, and honestly, I think that our community is the perfect messenger on this stuff because the community tends to lean conservative, lean Republican. But at the end of the day, they're pragmatists and, they care about, conservation. They care about maintaining, basically the best conservation system in the world that we have in this country. And, that requires, Democrats, Republicans. And what we're trying to do is conservation that is durable, that does not depend on having a Democrat or Republican in the White House or in the House of Representatives or in the Senate. These things make sense regardless of what party's in power. And if we maintain that we're true to that, then, I mean, you were at our dinner, you emceed our dinner last week, and we always honor one Republican, one Democrat, somebody from the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the whole theme, that there's plenty of,
and quite often that private sector individual is an industry, you know, someone
This year it was Ben Special, the head of, you know, Yamaha Marine. And Yamaha's done unbelievable things for
and
conservation.
And you honored someone from the beer industry.
Yep. New Belgium the year before that. And, I mean, it runs the gamut. But, you know, the whole point
but someone
is...
like someone from the corporate world who's running a great business, running a profitable business, but keeping in mind...
Yeah, we work a lot with corporate America, but we try to identify the leaders in each of the sectors. And not just, you know, Patagonia and REI, but... You know, we work a lot with Shell Oil because I think they're by far the most conservation-minded, progressive of the big oil companies. Mm-hmm. And listen, oil and gas is going to be here for a long time in the future, even if we get to a much more carbon-free society. I mean, my truck's only 2 years old. I mean, I'm going to be driving it for a long time, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to work with companies that really have a commitment to doing the right thing. And, you know, that's sometimes harder than other times. But, you know, like Ben Special at Yamaha, that's an easy one. I mean, they have walked the walk for a long time now. But I was going to say, I mean, there is plenty to disagree about in D.C., but these issues, hunting, fishing, conservation, should not be one of them.
Yep. All right, everyone. Whit Fosberg from TRCP. If you like Whit's approach.
TRCP.org.
Yeah, if you like Whit's approach and you like the kind of projects TRCP works on, tell them how to go find more.
Yeah, just go to our website. It's pretty wonky, but we try to boil it down so it's understandable for the layperson. And you know, become an activist. Membership is free. If you want to give us a little money in exchange for something, we'd love to have it. But you know, you'll get those updates weekly of what's happening in DC, and you'll have plenty of opportunities to weigh in yourself. And TRCP.org.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody. Hey, I'm excited to share our newest sponsor here on the Meat Eater Podcast, which is Poncho Outdoors. The reason I'm excited is I buy their shirts anyways. Dude, they make some good shirts. And they even have an option where if you're like a skinny dude, you can click like the skinny dude thing. It's great. Based in Austin, Texas, Poncho is committed to crafting the world's best outdoor shirts for men. Poncho is only sold on their own website. So head over to ponchooutdoors.com. Use code MEATEATER for a free hat or t-shirt with any purchase of a shirt. Poncho offers free shipping and returns, so you can try them out risk-free. Hey, if you follow wildlife news at all, you're probably aware that the island of Maui has an incredible abundance of axis deer, so much so that they're causing ecological damage. Well, Maui Nui venison is thinning out some of those axis deer herds and delivering venison sticks and fresh cuts to your door. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. Use promo code MeatEater for 20% off your order.